One day the police and the demolition squad of the municipality came about 10 in the morning after the morning program. And they said that, you know, the temple is illegal, the structure is illegal, and we're going to demolish it. So we had permission for it, and I'd actually gotten a renewal for it from the municipal commissioner. So I was protesting, and I said, I've got the renewal, and so on. But they weren't interested in hearing at all. Later, we heard that they had been paid by Mrs. Nyer, and that's the way officers work when they're paid. They don't care about the papers. They just do what they are going to do. So, you know, the police anticipated we might try to interfere with the demolition, so they had come along. And one by one, as the devotees tried to intervene, they were carried off by the police constables and put in the van. And finally, when all the devotees had been removed into the van was taken to the police station, and the devotees were kept there. But, you know, one of, you know, the most striking qualities of Srila Prabhupada as a leader, besides the courageousness that you mentioned, was the ability to see any reverse as positive. So here Srila Prabhupada said that, you know, that the incident has showed that we're not able to manage ourselves and we should take help from life members. So we should immediately call one meeting and invite all the members and get them involved. So there was like a very, Prabhupada was in Calcutta, there was like an immediate and positive response what to do next.
So that plan by Nair backfired, and all kinds of support came, sympathy, and so on. So we've used up our time. I hope this will give Giriraj Maharaj more encouragement to write his book. It's going to be a very exciting, interesting story. Thank you very much. Jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I have one question that was submitted. It's got a few parts to it. By Ambika Prabhu. So it's a thoughtful one. As a very early disciple of Srila Prabhupada, you had a close relationship with him. As the years went on and the movement expanded, you became one of thousands rather than one of 20. How did the early devotees feel as the intimacy they had previously experienced with Srila Prabhupada necessarily reduced? And then there's more parts to this, so it's a personal question. I don't know if I was ever asked this question before. People might not think of such a question. That a person who had close association with Prabhupada in the beginning would have any problem. But actually it was a problem. She says, was there any regret? It was painful, actually, for the devotees to lose that intimacy and become part of a big institution. Some devotees even left a Krishna consciousness when they couldn't get that anymore. So one thing we would do in the pain of that is to remember the times that we did have with Prabhupada. We like to remember that scene like I have been remembering it, 1966, when it was different. But so that helps to push us, help us push on, even though ISKCON becomes big and we become small, as to remember that it is based on the personal relationship that we did have. Then she asks, or did Srila Prabhupada still allow you to feel a special closeness due to your past closeness? Yes, he did that sometimes. One time, in 1976, when Prabhupada was in the Manhattan skyscraper temple, I came one afternoon, and he was in the midst of a darshan, a room full of people, and he was talking. So I walked in and sat in the back, and he noticed me and stopped his preaching and said, "Oh, come up, come forward." And I came up where he indicated and sat, and then he said, "You've just come?" And I said where I just came and everything. So little things like that, someone might take it, well, they had so much mercy, now they're just getting more mercy. But actually we were put into a difficult position by not getting the mercy anymore that we used to get. I'm already halfway through your question. But it was so difficult that sometimes I wouldn't even go places where Prabhupada went because of the crowds and the competition. And as I said, some devotees who used to have that, they just couldn't handle it at all, and so just left. But that doesn't speak very well for the seriousness of their Krishna consciousness, but it shows that there was a predicament, because probably they would have stayed if they could have had that situation that they had once. Therefore, we should appreciate and sympathize with Prabhupada and what he was doing to push on the movement, not think that there was anything wrong on his part for outgrowing a situation that he used to be in. So with that sympathy, well, Prabhupada is doing so much now that he wasn't doing. He's relating to so many people, worrying about so many things. So what I should do my service in this movement. And so, especially at the stage that we're at in devotional service, the real thing is to have some service and to serve. We don't love Krishna so much on an individual basis as a person. And the service is what we can put our energy and our love. And in his books, of course. Then the last part is, do you think it is a positive sentiment to feel some wistfulness that many of us joined later and missed out on the very early sweet days? So now the predicament is, now we're looking at the predicament of a different kind. Devotees who never had that and who hear about, never had the close association with His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, and hear about others who had it, and they feel, I wish I had been known him and been with him like that. So this is inevitable that we think like this. But we shouldn't allow it to depress us. And we should have faith that we can develop a personal relationship with Srila Prabhupada even now. That is not an imaginary idea. There was an incident with Jai Dwaita Maharaj. He's not here now to confirm this, but... Oh, there he is. I was about to say, but I was there also. And in fact, I took away my own interpretation and memory of it. But I'll ask him. We're talking about, first answering a question a devotee asked, first about devotees who had close association with Prabhupada in 1966 and around then, and then lost it as the movement got very, very big. How did they cope with that? So I explained that. Now we're shifting to devotees who never had that close association. And how can they cope hearing about people who had close association? So I'm thinking of an incident, or an exchange on a morning walk in Mayapur. And Jai Dwaj Maharaj asked, what about you have so many disciples and they want to know how you know about their service and how they're reciprocating with you. You want
to? I don't think I asked it in a walk, I asked it at Second Avenue. In 68 or something.
I have a memory of Mayapur, but you tell the one that you remember, I'll tell the one that I remember.
I asked Prabhupada how the spiritual master knows what the disciple is doing. The intention of my question was, if you're doing something, some service, how are you getting your brownie points for it? And he answered that the spiritual master is not a magician. And another answer he gave, he said, spiritual master is not a magician. He said, anyone can know. He said, face is the index of mind. So by seeing your face, anyone will know. That was the answer that he gave.
So at the Mayapur walk, he answered you and said, the GBC is there, they will see what his service is. So then you said, yes, they may be there, but what about you and their relationship with you, whether you know their service? So then he said, chant 16 rounds and follow the four rules. Just do that, that's all. Then around there, my memory fades out and the purport that I've supplied comes in. He said a few things more, but I preserve it in my mind like this. That he was saying that if you follow the four rules in 16 rounds, you become enthusiastic by that. And I was moved by this response. I thought it was an important question and answer. The movement was so big then. And even on that walk, only a few people were in the walk and hundreds were waiting in the Chaitanya Chandradaya Mandir. So I thought, yes, this is true, that all devotees, as they serve, they will become enthusiastic and have a personal relationship with Prabhupada. And this is going on, for example, with the book distributors and any devotee who's serving, he feels this. So then Prabhupada also said, why should you want attention? He said, you shouldn't think that because I'm serving, I want attention. But you should think that I don't deserve any attention. Not that I'm looking for it. And then to that, I remember supplying my own further understanding was that I was thinking that of an image almost of like a person in the darkness and someone going around to pay attention to him. He's doing something nonsense, and you turn the flashlight on him. Oh, there you are. And you're seen being a nonsense. So that's our position, that we're saying, I want attention, but if we're given attention, it will simply expose what a nonsense we are. And he wasn't exactly saying that, but he was saying that you are fallen and you should think like that. Not that I'm so wonderful, I should get attention. But I was thinking, rather, I'm such a nonsense. If I do get attention, that will be seen. Not that I'm so great, I should be loved and appreciated for all that I'm doing.
It shows you I was still looking for brownie points in 1970.
I think it was a question that was on a lot of people's minds anyway. How does he know I'm here? So he answered it. All right. Let there be a temple, part two. In Bombay, when Prabhupada was victorious in the fight to get the land, then the next fight came up that was getting permission to build. But in one lecture he gave while traveling away from Bombay, he was recalling the fight to get the land and describing, now we have a beautiful place in Juhu. He said, it is a very fine place, like a paradise. And he was satisfied thinking of this and telling his audience. So, he said, when we come to Krishna consciousness, there are no problems. This was a point he was developing in the lecture. And he related it to how he had gotten this wonderful place in Bombay, full of so much facility and potential. But this raises a question, which I'll ask you to answer. How could Prabhupada say there were no problems in Bombay? Since we just heard yesterday, it's just full of problems. But after it's over, he says, this is an example, there are no problems in Krishna consciousness. This is something that was described in the unabridged, and not, I think it's not in the other. Does anyone think of an how to answer this question? How to understand? Yes?
Because your prophet said one time that we have no anxieties, just headaches.
What's the difference?
Is that for Krishna we can accept so many burdens, but for God's person, they're not an anxiety.
Uh-huh. Yeah? It's a different kind of problem. Yes?
There's also a reciprocation that Krishna provides to the devotee when he's going through seeming difficulties on his behalf. As Bhagavad Gita describes that when I experience some distress or service, I take it as a great happiness because he knows he's being purified.
Good.
But then another point is that the whole maneuver by the nairs toward the devotees really turned into an asset for the devotees because it pulled a lot of needy people into the ISKCON fold. So it was like a nice move by Krishna to allow the whole arrangement to take place.
Some other points that I have noted about this was that Krishna arranged for the whole thing, and therefore the problems were overcome. The devotees didn't have any money, but they got the place. Mr. Nair was a very powerful person, trying in many ways to get them out, but they got the place because Krishna was in charge of that situation. So Prabhupada meant that. Although he didn't say that it was without any contest, but with Krishna in charge, there's no problem. Also, during the difficulties, he means that the devotee is never bewildered by Maya. It's another understanding. Prabhupada, in that same lecture about Bombay, went on to speak about the verse, Titikshava Karunika Suradam Savadehinam Ajata Satrava, the qualities of a sadhu. And we can think of that in terms of Bombay fight, that he showed those titiksha, tolerance, with all the difficulties. There's that story of about tolerance in Bombay. In 1977, Prabhupada was again reminiscing about Bombay, and this time he was living in the grand suite that had, in the completed building. So he was remembering, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Giriraj Maharaj were there, and they said, Prabhupada, you were such a great soldier in that fight against those people and everything. And Prabhupada said, yes, that dog. And they thought that he was using a name for Mr. Nair. Then he went on, he said, one time we were driving in a car with the lawyer, and he had a big German Shepherd dog, which I had to go in the car right beside me. So that dog was another example of so many things he had to tolerate. Karunika, he was merciful, He could have left and said, I don't need this place. I have so many temples. But he wanted to give them Krishna consciousness and develop something wonderful. Suradam Sarvadehinam, a friend to all. And he did not create enemies. Now, we'll turn our attention to Mayapur. These are, of course, partial portraits. We're just trying to see Prabhupada in different situations as much as we can. After getting the land, Prabhupada planned the first building, which was a four-story guest house. But the entire project was a huge idea. This first building, the deities were on the ground floor, and the living quarters were above. So some people criticized Prabhupada that the deities are on the ground floor and you're on top of the deities. Does anyone remember what Prabhupada replied to that? Yes.
This shows that the devotees of Krishna are more important than Krishna's.
Yeah, that's one thing he said. That he said, this is not the temple. You have not yet to see the temple. But we have to build something first for the devotees. So first of all, it's not wrong to build first for the devotees. They're more important. But anyway, this is not the temple. Krishna will be situated very nicely. And then he said, anyway, everything is Krishna and you are walking on the road. So you're also walking on Krishna, if that is your logic. This project has been modified and new plans again and again have been submitted. But we're mostly discussing just Prabhupada's vision at that time. So when some devotees heard this big project and saw what they had just out there in the rice fields, they also asked the question, Prabhupada, what are we going to do out here if we move to that land? And what did he reply at that time? Do anyone remember? He said, we'll chant Hare Krishna. And he began to criticize the devotees that they think they have to be doing so many things in order to be engaged in Krishna consciousness. Is so restless. But our purpose in Mayapur is to just go there and chant Hare Krishna. But you cannot appreciate this. The first large gathering was in 1972 of devotees from different, mostly just from different parts of India. At first, Prabhupada wanted to make the first annual meeting of devotees there, but then he saw there were not facilities and it was just too far off. It also seemed very difficult for us in the West to even think of going to India. How could we go to India? Where we would get the money, and how could we leave our positions? So that didn't happen. But there was a festival in 72. And that gives us an idea of how primitive the conditions were. Does anyone remember some of the features of the 72 festival? Well, that too is just that's an unabridged description. Yes. What?
They had one tent.
Just tents. Yeah, no buildings, just tents. And what did Prabhupada live in? Did he live in a tent?
He was this small hut.
Ah, yeah. He lived in a small hut, thatched hut, and he said about that. They said, "We're sorry, Prabhupada." There was an outhouse, no plumbing, and it was just one 12 by 12 room with a little space, thin space divided for his servant. And they said, we're sorry, this is all we have now. And he said, even if you build me the biggest palace, still I would prefer to live here. He liked it. There was a groundbreaking ceremony for the first temple then. There are some very nice pictures of that Prabhupada sitting with all his godbrother, with some of his godbrothers, many of them, and his disciples, and then even a picture of him going down into the pit, 15-foot pit, to plant the Anantashesh. There was also a controversy then about his use of the word Prabhupada, because that was the name used for Bhakti Saranda Saraswati Thakur, and some of the disciples of him thought that it should not be used. But I think I've explained that in the Prabhupada Lilamrita. Then, another memory that I can share with you was from a year later, 1973, which gives us some picture of what of Prabhupada living in Mayapur when the building was still unfinished, but at least was livable. He, in other words, his room was fixed, but there was hammering and so much work going on throughout the rest of that one single building. I went there for a month because there was a rotating system that GBC secretaries would stay one month after another with Prabhupada. Briefly, I'll read a few things that I wrote in a diary while there from his room conversation. This was in June 73. Prabhupada said that at least in his books, the word Krishna appears about four times on each page, so even if the rest is rubbish, at least the name Krishna, Krishna, Krishna is there. June 19. Went to Calcutta, had jeep accident. Bhavananda hurt his legs. In the evening, kirtan at Calcutta temple, led by Dinanath, anxious to get back to Mayapur. June 20, returned to Mayapur. Prabhupada chastised me. You should have common sense for not insisting that the bank accept our checks. They should have written their refusal to us, stating why. Just see what Prabhupada was demanding. Somebody told me, no, they wouldn't do something that Prabhupada asked me to do. I tried again, no, you should do this. No, we won't do it. And I thought, well, that's it. But he said, you should have got it in writing from them, from the clerk, why he won't do it. Prabhupada decided definitely not to go to Australia for Ratha Yatra, Shama Sundar and Mukunda visit. Prabhupada plays George Harrison's new album and says, any intelligent man will be able to see he has been infected with Krishna consciousness. Wonderful menial service as secretary to His Divine Grace. Prabhupada was talking about a plan to send, someone had raised the plan that we could send two men to open Krishna consciousness in a village and then another two men somewhere else. Prabhupada said, but where are such expert men? If you send an ordinary man, what can he do? He will after a few months close it. But development is to send Sankirtan party. It takes a very expert man. I was just one man and I opened 100 centers. One time Prabhupada called me into his room and asked me, did I know any places in the world where they had good water that could cure indigestion? Which he was having a problem with. So, mostly your relationship with Prabhupada was with awe and reverence, so I was flattered that he called me in for such an intimate talk about ordinary things, but I didn't know where in the world there was any good water. And there are a number of times like that Prabhupada would ask me or others something normal about the world, and we proved our ignorance by not knowing. We not only didn't know Vedic scriptures, we didn't know much of anything. Here's some brief statements by Prabhupada about Mayapur. He appreciated the atmosphere and said that the breezes were Vaikuntha breezes. Of course, that word is permanently used now. He said, every moment we are passing in great delight at Mayapur. When a very big storm came, he said, there's no place in the world like Mayapur. He was like thrilled. Mayapur is so wonderful, you can live on the air and water alone. After this time when I was with him, after a few weeks then he went to Calcutta and Prabhupada became sick there with dysentery. perhaps due to something his sister cooked. It happened right after that. So it was serious, but then it passed. He was still recovering. And he was thinking what to do now. And all the sannyasis who were present and GBC men came in. And we all, first we met among ourselves, then we went in and suggested that Prabhupada should go to Hawaii and rest. So he listened and said, and then he said he would decide, but then he decided no, he wouldn't do that. He wanted to preach, and he had this extravagant, long and exaggerated telegram from Shyamasundara saying what was awaiting in London, including it would be a helicopter to pick him up, and there was allusions that the Prince Charles would probably be taking instructions from him. Yeah, on and on. So it's not that Prabhupada was gullible, but he thought, yes, I want to go to that Rata Yatra. So he subdued all of his own disciples who were his leaders and showed his own strength of mind, because he was physically weak, but he had a strong mind. And this is very characteristic of Prabhupada, and he admired this in disciples also, if they had strong minds. And I would give an example of this to show that not only spiritually, but even in the world, he said, a person may not be so strong physically, but if he has a strong brain, then he'll do all right in the world. He's a strong man. And Prabhupada admired this in disciples, because then they could do so many things in Krishna consciousness. But that doesn't mean he didn't admire simple disciples, but then they should serve according to their capacity. So this is in the diary. I bring it up for this point. He was talking about me as his temporary secretary and wondering what was going to happen at the... A lot of travel was coming up, international travel. Whether there would be, when we go to the airport, whether there would be any entanglement with customs and so on. I said no, because I'd just gotten the tickets and everything. I said there would be no problem. He said, you say that, but when we go to the airport, there may be a problem. Then he said to the other devotees there about me, he is doing his best, but he does not have experience. If every month a new man, then I have to suffer. Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, but we suffer when you get angry upon us. Prabhupada said, but your suffering is secondary. He said that he was detained 3 hours in Paris and practically jailed for days from Africa to Australia. He said, I am coming and going so much. I am a little bit known. I should not have to wait on lines. That is the job of the secretary. He should be so expert that these rascals with all their rules are answered, and I am not detained as an ordinary person. And then he said, you have to have a brain, always alert. One who has a brain has strength. I don't know what to advise if one doesn't have a strong brain, what to do. At least don't bluff that you have a strong brain. And I suppose there are things we can do to develop our brains, to gain knowledge, gain experience, and then become strong persons, not weak. Now, staying with the Mayapur talk, a year later, the 1974 festival in Mayapur was the first international festival that's now held every year. This is the first time that a GBC meeting was held, and Prabhupada set the model how it should be held, with passing of resolutions, and they should come before him for final ratification. The building wasn't finished, but there were about 400 devotees from all over the world. And in a lecture, Prabhupada declared that now the prophecy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur has been fulfilled, that Westerners will come together with Bengalis and chant Hare Krishna. So this reference to the previous acharyas, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and in this case, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, was very much on Prabhupada's mind. that he was carrying out the vision of predecessors, not just something of his own. He saw himself as an instrument carrying out their will. So I have a question for the devotees about this. In our own meditation on Prabhupada, should we pray to the previous acharyas when we pray for the mercy, or just to Prabhupada? And if we do pray to them, how should we approach them? Anyone want to make any comment on this? Jai George Maharaj?
My comment is that a lot of people call that as a previous acharya.
Right. So, in that case, okay, open the question more. Should you just pray to your own spiritual master? Or to the previous acharyas? And also specifically okay, you say, should you stop at Prabhupada as you go back to the previous acharyas? Or what is the relationship, non-Prabhu? The grandfather is more merciful than the father. Right. So we should certainly, just like he taught us the prayers from the 1966 Mangalacharana prayers. So we should think that Prabhupada is coming in the line of the cyclic succession, and through him we are receiving the mercy and developing relationship with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and so on. But there's, at the same time, there's a special relationship we all have with Prabhupada, even those who are initiated by ISKCON gurus in the disciplic succession. What Prabhupada has given as a standard is to be followed by us. Anyone want to comment on that? In other words, he's not just number 32 or whatever it is in the disciplic succession. He's the founder acharya, and his teachings are most important to us. Now, we'll talk a little bit about the development of Vrindavan. In 1974, Prabhupada really pushed and pushed that they get his residence done, the residence that we have now. And I was with him when he came, the first time he moved in there, and it was the floor was, the cement was still not completely dry, and they had, for the last 24 hours, they had heaters on the wall trying to dry things, and so and that produced some bugs. So it wasn't quite ready. But he insisted that it must be ready, so he moved into this unfinished place, which is now finished. And aside from that, one room in that residential building, nothing else was done. It was just a raw construction site. So he lived there in 74. I remember he was visited by Ravi Shankar and George Harrison during that visit. And mainly he worked with his leaders there, and pressing them for when this project would be completed and we could have a grand opening. During this time also, the man who gave, this land was donated, Krishna Balaram land, and that man, while Prabhupada was here, sent a communication that he was going to take back the first 50 feet for his own purposes. So what did Prabhupada do when that was done? Negative.
Asked his secretary to bring in the Krishna book and read the chapter of King
Raghav.
And then?
Type
that letter. Type that chapter up. And
send it to Mr. And then he did other things too. He had somebody that he knew in Calcutta go see him and try to convince him, don't do this, it's not good. And so he relented and didn't try to take that front 50 feet. I want to talk about Prabhupada revealing the Dham when he was in Vrindavan during these years, after realize that he was struggling to build the facility so that we all could come and enjoy Vrindavan Dham, or purify ourselves in Vrindavan Dham, on a standard that Westerners could handle, and a beautiful place where people from all over the world could come and worship Krishna Balaram, Radha Krishna. So he wanted down-to-earth work and development of the temple. But I'm going to give some evidence that even during these early years, he was appreciating Vrindavan Dham in his writings and in his behavior. In case anyone has a wrong impression that he was only scolding devotees and he was withholding the sweetness of Vrindavan, you can see that's not true. For example, in a 1970 visit, he went on Braj Parikram with 40 devotees. And I'll read something I wrote about that, which shows both aspects. You went to the Kshima Sarovara, where Radha and Krishna enjoyed. At Barshana, the devotees carried you on a palanquin up the stairs. While at the home of Radharani, you said little, because what could we understand? Only, just over there, Krishna used to come down that hill. Radha would come down this hill, and they would meet in the middle. There was a forest there, so this is a very special place. You had revealed and wanted a center in Vrindavan, and that was the main thing. How it would come about was yet unclear. As your disciples could not realize fully Krishna's leelas, so they also could not grasp your order. Who among them would be ready to live and work all year through the harsh Vrindavan climate, battling with bureaucrats and workers to construct a temple? Maybe that is why you were silent on Parikram, wondering who among these sight-seeing children would endure and create a temple in the Dham. You had defended your followers with Shastric references that they should be accepted as Brahmins, sannyasis, and pujaris. Your followers were bona fide bhaktas. You were very strong arguing these points with the caste Goswamis. But when it came to substantial work, who among them would stay and manage a construction site? And from where would the money come? As yet you had only a promise of Raman Reti land. Patiently you depended on Krishna and continued on Parikram, dunking and splashing in the river Yamuna, your men shouting in glee, Prabhupada, Prabhupada. Then on a walk in 1974, almost any time Prabhupada would go on a walk in Vrindavan, devotees would try to bring up questions about the meaning of Vrindavan. Prabhupada, how can we understand that Vrindavan is Krishna's abode? There seems to be so much contamination in Vrindavan. This is because your senses are impure, said Prabhupada. But when your eyes are smeared with the salve of love, then you can see Vrindavan. Don't judge Vrindavan by this external manifestation. Prabhupada appreciated that people would greet him and say, Jai Radhe, although we know it's a kind of a cheap thing in a sense, the way they say it all the time, and not necessarily our devotees on a right standard. He said this is a real sign of the specialness of Vrindavan, that even a common person says the name of Srimati Radharani.
It's the gift of Rupa and Sanatan, Prabhupada said. They wrote many books so poor people can take advantage and become Krishna conscious. Then he began to define what is a Goswami, and this he did often. He said he wanted the devotees, especially those who lived here, to be Goswamis, and to defeat the caste Goswamis by one way or another, by example and even by lecturing. What is real Goswami? One walk he asked Gurudas, who was in charge then, what is a Goswami? So he said, one who works hard day and night and controls it for Krishna and controls his senses. Prabhupada liked that answer. And then he began to describe the verse, Vacho Vegam. But he liked this theme. What is a Goswami? And you will find it in the prayers to the six Goswamis. They're the ideal Goswamis. Another time, Prabhupada had open meetings in his room. But the first night, very few people came. Maybe they didn't know it was there, the meeting was there, or they were shopping and so on. So he commented, coming to pilgrimage means to come where the sadhus are. I am here, so why is everyone going elsewhere? Then he spoke about austerity. that the tapasvis in Vrindavan go naked, even in the cold. This life is for tapasya, but we cannot execute severe penances. Our penance is to try to reform poor, crazy persons, to reform fallen souls. Don't commit offenses. There's a special influence in Vrindavan. So these are examples that Prabhupada did talk about Vrindavan and the mystery of Vrindavan and how it can be revealed when he was here. But he certainly pushed for the worldwide preaching when his devotees got together and for the construction and opening of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. There's a story which we won't have time to get into how, and as time goes by, it may not seem so significant that the devotees promised a grand opening and then it wasn't ready on time. But the one thing that we want to remember about that is when Prabhupada came, at the time it was just before the grand opening in 1974, he came and then he saw, this place is not ready, there's not going to be any opening. And they admitted, no, there's not going to be any opening. So he was angry, and he called in one leader after another and yelled at them and showed his anger. So how can we understand this anger of the pure devotee Prabhupada in this particular situation? Those who have read the explanations of Prabhupada's anger that the grand opening did not occur. Yes?
You said,
you're giving a reasonable explanation that why anybody would be angry that after advertising an event, then it doesn't happen. It's an embarrassment to the movement. How else? Because we might think that he shouldn't get angry. So some of the reasons I have in Prabhupada Lilamrita, that it was a way of instructing and testing his disciples. Also, it was a way of expressing his impatience, a transcendental impatience, to carry out the order of his spiritual master and present the world with a wonderful temple for establishing Krishna consciousness in Vrindavan all over the world. If somebody said, oh Prabhupada, what does it matter? In this year, next year, we'll get it. It'll open one of these days. But Prabhupada was, he didn't have that much time, and he didn't like that kind of attitude. Because anything could come in between it actually being carried out and it never being carried out unless it got done right away. And his lamentation was spiritual, because when his disciples failed, as in this case, he had to take the burden. One of the practical problems was cement, just like now with the samadhi, it's marble. So there's a little portrait of how finally when the government gave permission and it was available, many truckloads arrived, and you see how Prabhupada was so absorbed in cement. There's one anecdote about Prabhupada that he arrived from Europe to India, in Delhi. And there was a fanfare. His disciples couldn't get near him at first. It was just a big fanfare in the airport. And then finally he got into the car and he sat next to Guru Das, who was in charge then, and a few other devotees in the car. And then the first word Prabhupada said, he hadn't said anything yet, he said, cement. And then he began to talk about it. One expects the guru maybe to say, you know, all is one or something. Transcendence. Okay. But he said cement. So then this is the story of when they got a big shipment. Prabhupada had Gunanava count every bag of cement as it arrived. From 8 in the morning until 9:30 at night, the shipment kept coming on trucks, each truck with four coolies to carry the heavy bags on their backs into the storage shed. Gunanava stood outside all day with pad and pen, marking the receipt of each bag. Srila Prabhupada came out of the house several times and watched gravely. In the evening when they were finished, he called Gunanava in. "So, how many bags?" Prabhupada asked, and Gunanava gave the exact figure. "Everything is locked away now?" Prabhupada asked. "Yes, Srila Prabhupada." Prabhupada talked about the cement as if talking about a shipment of gold. So all this difficulty that devotees underwent has resulted in the establishing these three wonderful temples where we all live and visit. And although we may think there are difficulties, it's nothing. It's so comfortable now compared to what it used to be. We can appreciate their service. Since we're hearing about Prabhupada's involvement in so much management, and we know that he was also writing Srimad Bhagavatam, and in the description of, about the author and his books, it says the most important thing Prabhupada did was write his books. So a question may be raised that if Prabhupada didn't have to manage so much, then he could have written more books. And so this can be raised with a feeling of regret and an implication that it would have been better that he had done the books and that his work is incomplete. So you're shaking your head no. How would you answer this? Could you answer this question?
It's one thing to understand over. We have to understand the person better as well, how he acts in his personal dealings externally as well.
So what is the example he showed by taking time away from writing the books to manage and construct the temples? What is the... Can you explain the example?
All I can say is that he showed in every practical way in his life how he dealt with things respectfully as the
Vaishnavas. So you're making a good point. That it's not just writing ideal philosophy, but how he acts. So in this case, the book writing was very dear to him and it was a very important part of the preaching. It was his service, but he gave it up partially in order to do the needful. And this is an example for all of us that even what is our pet service or our service may have to sometimes be sacrificed for what is actually the larger needs of the ISKCON movement. What are some other answers to this question that would have been better if Prabhupada didn't manage so much? Maharaj?
Well, if he didn't manage so much, then the movement wouldn't go there. The book distribution wouldn't be there. The practical development of the devotee's life wouldn't be there. The manifestation of Krishna consciousness, the context of the books wouldn't be there.
Yeah. He wanted to leave us not only with books, but with a strong movement. Sometimes what he did, it didn't seem fruitful. Perhaps he would talk to somebody and they would fall down anyway. But he had to do it. And it was fruitful in the main. Another thing to say is that although he sacrificed to some degree his literary output, still it's not like, a tragic story. This person, he could have given the world so much, but he didn't. But he was very prolific. People say, how could you write all those books? So it's just that he didn't finish the Srimad Bhagavatam and some other things, but in the main, he did also complete his work. I think you had I don't want to say a problem, but that was really on your mind, how he could have left and not finished.
Well, I just felt convinced that he wouldn't until he did.
So it was like a shock because you feel he's not going to leave because he hasn't finished the books. So we're almost finished. Just to sum up, let's see where we are. Yeah, there's that expression, there's an expression that about these three places, Bombay, Mayapur and Vrindavan, an expression of Prabhupada's in which he described succinctly his relationship or his purpose in each place. Bombay is my... I'm going to leave the blanks first. Bombay is my... Mayapur is my and Vrindavan is my. So fill in the blanks. Who can say? Yes? Okay. So what would it mean that Bombay is his office? So Chandra, could you say something? How is it his office? How can we see that Bombay is his office? Alitamanjaya.
It's the most modern city in India.
It's the most modern city in India. He established his BBT there. He would do legal work there, not only for Bombay, but other places. When he would go there, he would consult lawyers. And the biggest donors in ISKCON were from Bombay. So whatever you conceive of that would be an office for a spiritual movement, it would be better centered in Bombay than in the town of Vrindavan or the town of Mayapur, certainly, or other towns in India. So we understand office, something like that. Mayapur is my place of worship. How could that be explained? Anybody? Yes? The home of Lord Chaitanya. So he worships Lord Chaitanya. And how do we worship Lord Chaitanya? Sankirtan. So the Sankirtan movement began in Navadvip, Mayapur. So we worship Lord Chaitanya there, and by chanting Hare Krishna and spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world out of Mayapur, building a beautiful place there to worship and serve as the inspiration for propagation and visiting. Giriraj Maharaj also gave another understanding that because Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur is from there, and Samadhi is there, and Prabhupada worships his spiritual master as part of as his main source of inspiration for spreading Krishna consciousness. And Vrindavan is my residence. Vinod Vani, you see?
Well, Prabhupada's heart is in Vrindavan.
So a person, he has to come home. He can go and preach and do his office work, but then he has to come home. So this transcendentally, this is the ultimate home. Even when Prabhupada was in New York, he talked about Vrindavan. He was also seen as a Swami from Vrindavan. You come from Vrindavan. And the people here saw him like that, the hometown sadhu who would spread Krishna consciousness. And of course then, eternally, spiritually, he goes back to Godhead to join Krishna in eternal Vrindavan. So it's his eternal home. But even it had that feeling in his manifested Leela that he would come here and be at home in Vrindavan once it was developed. Anyway, that's what he said. So we can only try to understand it a little bit. And so Vrindavan should be our home, and Mayapur our place of worship. And we have some Prabhudatta Desh, which may be Bombay or maybe somewhere else, where we can serve Srila Prabhupada. All right. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ji jai. Prabhupada has just arrived. Question from Sarvabhoma. At one point, Srila Prabhupada spoke of taking 6 months in some isolated part of the world to be able to write, etc. But then he renounced this idea for a preaching opportunity in Europe. It is said that a preacher loses his private life, yet it appears that Prabhupada relished the private early morning hours of his translations and that he generally took prasadam by himself. Lord Chaitanya liked mass preaching, but sometimes he wanted to avoid crowds. The question is, to what extent did Prabhupada appreciate privacy, and to what extent do you think he renounced it to serve Krishna, and how did this change as the movement grew larger? My answer is, whether being alone or with people, Prabhupada did whatever was best for Krishna's service.
So when he was alone, that was done not selfishly. As for whether this changed, I would say that as the movement grew, Prabhupada preserved more privacy for himself, or he insulated himself because he gained more control over his time when he had some people who were willing to actually assist and do things. He didn't have to do everything himself. He had senior disciples who used to do the things that he did. In the beginning of his preaching in New York, he cooked. He was present at Prasadam daily, and on Sunday with the guests. But then he didn't have to do all those things, and he acted in a way more befitting for the founder, Acharya. He saw visitors at a scheduled time, not whenever they wanted to see him. You can read that in the Hari Sori's diary. If I can make a personal comment, I find that being alone, when you are alone, you can get things done. So we don't go alone for enjoyment, but for productivity and quality and service, which you can't do if you're always with people. So that has to be balanced. Is that all right? This lecture is called Uniting Two Worlds, which is the title of the Prabhupada Lilamrita. Prabhupada himself gave us this concept of his mission. And we're speaking of different things today, especially about the growth of book distribution and something about U.S. tour and so on. But we'll try to group things under this theme as a way to appreciate his major activities near the end of his manifested preaching career, 1975-76. So one meaning of uniting two worlds is a combination of the blind man and the lame man. Can someone explain this image and how Prabhupada used it, the blind man and the lame man? Yes.
Then he has vision.
Huh?
So Prabhupada explained that India has spiritual vision, but it has no technology. The very West technology, which is compared to the left, it has no spiritual vision. So
you
can still call
knowledge and spiritual vision. Just as if a blind man and a lame man got together, they could function, they could walk and see together, but they have to cooperate, not alone. So with Western money and technology and other Western things, the message of India, spiritual India, can be spread all over the world, but India is crippled in different material ways, not able to do it. What is another meaning of uniting two worlds? Yes?
Spiritual.
Yeah, bringing together. There are two worlds. There's a spiritual world, Vaikuntha is in Krishna Loka, and there are these material worlds, and they seem to be always apart. Is that a poem? East is east, and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. But they can be. Prabhupada was doing bringing them together, the material and the spiritual world. So the principle by which that is done is yukta vairagya, because they seem to be opposed, like the as Prabhupada wrote, an easy journey to other planets. There's a material world and an anti-material world, but they can be brought together by yukta vairagya, using material things in the service of Krishna. There's a Bhagavatam verse that says all art and culture and business and science and philosophy and so on may be used to glorify the Lord. Another example would be Varnashram, an example of uniting material and spiritual. So to discuss book distribution and how it grew, that can also be seen as in uniting two worlds theme, that with the facility to publish books by having money and technology in the West, then Prabhupada's the timeless wisdom of his purports and translations could come about so nicely. And then also the practices of wide book distribution requiring sales and in using even competition and Western aggressiveness and so on, in its purified form, at least, taken together with the Vedas, which Prabhupada said used to be locked up in Sanskrit, protected, but nobody could get at them. Now it comes out, and it goes all over the world by a combination. For example, the Bombay temple that we're talking about, that was built by American money from book distribution. Another combination. So we gave a history of book distribution in the Prabhupada Lilamrita 6. And the history is a testimony by the devotees. In a sense, it's their story. We don't hear so much that Prabhupada was distributing the books the way he was in Delhi, or that Prabhupada was writing the books as in all our activity, all our descriptions, it's been always Prabhupada. So for this history, in a sense, he's in the back, but he's the motivating force to it all. As he described in his last months, that his enemies, they wonder, is that old man still beating the drum? They don't know where he is, and but he's there. He was there in Vrindavan beating the drum, and by his books being distributed and by his request, this enthusiastic disciples all over the world were madly distributing the books and telling him about this success, and he would encourage them. So he's behind it all. It's a testimony to the devotees in response to their feeling of debt to Prabhupada. And it's in response to his direct statements that they should do it, they should continue it. Before 1971, the distribution of literature was very small. But Prabhupada began to stress it more and said that this was an order of his spiritual master that he was following blindly, whether not knowing what the result would be, but the guru's order must be followed. In the beginning, it wasn't book distribution, it was magazines was all we had, Back to Godhead magazines. So Prabhupada was pleased to hear even a few hundred were distributed. Sub-centers, that was their monthly quota, 200, 400. But especially Los Angeles began to increase their magazine distribution, starting to do as many as 100 a day. This encouraged Prabhupada, and he asked it to do more. He said, every gentleman will give a quarter for BTG. That's how much it costs, 25 cents. And one center would discover how to distribute them better and would pass to another. In Boston, we used to do what we heard they did in other places, and which we developed in our own center. We go to parks. The magazine distribution was accompanied by Harinam very much. The two went together. So that later it became like almost a crisis for devotees. Whether when Prabhupada emphasized book distribution more and more, we said, well, which is more important? Because somehow they seem to have to go together. They went together, they'd go together very nicely. We would go into the park and chant, and people would come around, and then some devotees would distribute the magazines. As is still done on Harinam, but this was the only distribution, more or less. And then we would go into the streets and do walking Harinam, and devotees would go off from that party and distribute magazines. But books was very difficult to conceive, how the big books could be distributed. we didn't think, nobody thought so much of distributing Prabhupada's volumes from India, and there weren't that many of them. But the first book that was produced in America was Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. It was a very difficult book, in a sense, to even read and distribute. But that has never stopped the book distribution, a book being highly technical. Nor did Prabhupada think any of his books were disqualified, really, from mass distribution. Then the Krishna book came out. So there's a story that how they were received. The first copies came to Prabhupada right while he was at the Ratha Yatra in Golden Gate Park, San Francisco. So what happened on that occasion? Does anyone remember? Lindy? He sold them all. He didn't even keep one for himself. So that was the beginning of the Krishna book distribution. And then devotees began to find ways to distribute them. Started traveling in cars or vans, and sometimes selling the books in exchange for gasoline. Who can claim that they were the first ones to start book distribution? But at least some of the first attempts were like that. That by accident, almost, some devotees in a gas station had no money, and they offered to, or just started talking with the gas attendant, and wound up giving some books in exchange for gas. Then got a glimpse of the potency and that these books, how they could be distributed. Then this mostly in San Francisco, the Krishna book started. Devotees started standing outside grocery stores and had good success. And then they started going door to door. And by the BBT newsletter, was put out by Karander, then he started pushing other centers. So we're doing so many books, you should compete with us. And this competition started. We asked, what's the secret? There was no secret. You just go out and try to present the book. Try it. So this way, door to door, Krishna book distribution started. And Prabhupada, he was very enthusiastic in response, especially to the San Francisco Center, and he sent a letter. Sometimes they're selling as many as 70 Krishna books daily. If this is true, then when I return to the U.S., I must come to stay in your temple. By distributing my books profusely, you are giving me great encouragement to translate, and you're helping me to fulfill the order of my Guru Maharaj. I'm so grateful to you, I am sure Krishna will bless you a million times over for doing this work. So this phrase here, a million times over, that was really exciting for everybody. And it pushed on the feeling of competition. The distribution of books individually or as a story of how it began in this movement is one of excitement, you could even say euphoria and bliss, as well as austerity. But thinking about this, the blissful response that one gets. When I was preparing this outline, I used the word euphoria. And in one dictionary, euphoria has an all-positive definition in the American dictionary, a feeling of vigor, well-being, or high spirits. So this captures the essence of a successful book distribution experience. But I looked in the Oxford Dictionary, and there was another meaning which I think we think of with the word euphoria also.
well-being or confidence, especially one based on overconfidence or over-optimism. So by that definition, euphoria is a bliss that it goes away, almost like a drug-intoxicated thing. So we will try to think of the book distribution in those two ways, as being genuine spiritual bliss and how it may be something else also. There are a number of devotees here who have been distributing books either sometimes or a lot of times. So you please participate when I ask for questions. So I'll ask devotees who have distributed books, in your experience, what is the nature of that bliss of that one gets in distributing books? Ron?
Chaitanya, the Acharyas, Srila Prabhupada's service when their instructions were going out. So that bliss is taking their association in the service.
The association of Lord Chaitanya and Prabhupada. Do you think that there is a special quality to this experience that is different from other services? Yes? Speak loudly.
Book distribution enabled me to forget about myself, the total self, mind, body. You transcend that, it's very intense, and transcend this total self. And you experience that Lord Chaitanya is willing to use me as an instrument.
What about the question, is it different than other services? So basically, it's faster or easier. The same things that can be gained elsewhere, but can be gained with more intensity. Because those things are common to all service. Surrender, forgetting body, mind, and words, and materially. But the claim may be, for book distribution, just like Prabhupada said about India, the service in India is worth more than in the West. I think... take your words to be like that. Yes? What do you mean by that?
The nature of
family business. How do you feel that? Prabhupada said that, but what does that mean? How have you experienced that?
Like, it's an instruction or
so you feel satisfied by following that remark and so many remarks about book distribution. That's, if anything is mainstream and you wonder, well, is this a bona fide order? Is this pleasing Prabhupada? Certainly you don't have to think so much about book distribution, whether it is or not. Certainly you have that confidence. Yes?
From my own experience, is that every time I go out to book distribution, like forced me to be Krishna conscious and forced me to be Krishna conscious. So therefore, I would be able, you know, to check out where I am, I'll be able, you know, to find out ways my consciousness.
Yeah, I see.
Then, you know, this I experience.
Your actual position is exposed of where you're actually at in Krishna consciousness.
Force me to become Krishna consciousness.
Yes?
My own personal experience was that I became a devotee after reading Srila Prabhupada's book. And even though I was very much against the Hare Krishna movement, so much so that I screamed the Hare Krishna movement, the Supreme Court feeling. But reading Srila Prabhupada's books made me a devotee. So when I distribute the books, I get the feeling that even the most unlikely people to become devotees will become devotees. That is a lot of pleasure when you think that that will happen.
Direct experience of helping people and bringing people to Krishna consciousness produces the bliss.
Gautama Krishna Maharaj was speaking in the class about the compassion of the Vaishnava. So you taste that. Another question is that the other kind of euphoria may come on book distribution, not from the right things, but from attachment to big results or feeling yourself to be empowered, a great devotee, and the cause of the result. So how can one avoid these pitfalls? Janmashtami?
Well, it may be a little hard to avoid initially, but when you stay with the book distribution, Krishna will withdraw the results, and then once consciousness is really tested for a period of time, by the nature of the service, it requires so much surrender, because sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not, sometimes we're sick, sometimes we're in good health. But if we stay with it, then we get right to the essence of it. It's simply a service to please the Tantra. And if one has that in mind, then the thick and thinness of the temporary experience will deter us from doing the service.
Therefore, even if the book distributor has imperfect motives, he should not give up. That was Prabhupada's spirit. Devotees would come to him and tell him how imperfect the book distribution was going on, and so many faulty techniques were being used. And Prabhupada, he didn't like when he heard they were cheating techniques, but he would tell the critics of book distribution that then you do it another way, you do it a better way, but they're distributing the books, so that must continue. If you know a better way, then you do it that way, but don't stop the book distribution. You've addressed it from that point of view, that even if there is some false motive, the person should go on, he must go on, he'll be purified. In other words, it's not all euphoria, whether real or false, but it's hard work. And so you'll have to be determined. You can't just live on the false platform and go on with it. Just the virtue of continuing. And you must depend on Krishna in order to continue. But we have to work from some kind of satisfaction. So how do you learn to find satisfaction even in the face of so many obstacles and difficulties from the world, the non-devotees, and from your own mind? Yes? So even in the midst of bad days, some good experience. Kirtita, how do you go on when it's so difficult? All right. Prabhupada's order, distribute my books. He said, if a person reads one page, his life can be turned toward perfection. If 1% of the readers become devotees, the whole world will change. Prabhupada was particularly pleased because it was the order he received from his spiritual master. He said that by going out to distribute books, devotees were helping him to carry out the order of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Prabhupada gave many instructions and established many programs, but it is clear that he gave emphasis to book distribution. At times there have been abuses by Prabhupada's followers of these instructions. For example, devotees would preach to other devotees in the temple that anyone who doesn't distribute books is in Maya, if he has some other service. So we go to extremes in the name of generating enthusiasm. There have also been abuses in terms of techniques that were adopted to distribute the books. Yet the basic instruction remains. Perhaps as a backlash to these abuses, in some places in ISKCON, just the mention of book distribution brings opposition. The young devotees who are distributing books not only have to surmount obstacles and opposition from the non-devotees, but they also have to surmount opposition from their own community of devotees sometimes. How can this trend be reversed, and how can we create a favorable spirit toward book distribution, which is so obviously pleasing to Prabhupada? Would you like to answer that? I know one person would like to answer. Anybody else? John Mustin?
it's not easy to answer no. In some parts of the world, that's not really a problem. But it seems that where it's not a problem, there's an opposition within the temple community or within the country. It's where the topmost leadership is putting this as the highest priority. So it seems that on all levels that the emphasis has to be taken up.
And of course, those reasons for opposition, they're deep, like the wounds are deep and the abuses were real. So part of reversing the trend is to assure everyone that we're not going to continue that false preaching among devotees or flim-flam techniques.
It's one interesting point in this. It's like in the United States where the abuses became so bad that the public image was just shattered. And as a result of that, we probably lost the Supreme Court case 15 years after the fact. But now none of the airports are closing down because the local authorities don't feel that it's a problem. But it's kind of a backlash from the history, but the changes in the book distribution terminology remain. So a lot of these like adverse opinions are coming from a historical perspective and not necessarily real. I guess it's a question of disseminating information or improving the public image of book distribution.
I would like to read some brief excerpts from the Prabhupada Lilamrita of devotees' realizations by distributing books.